I'm Marty Moscoe, and welcome to Radio Times. Does the country need a second stimulus package? That's a question being asked by some just 6 months after the first stimulus package, totaling $787 billion, was passed. Although there are some signs of life in the U.S. economy, the country is still shedding jobs. The national unemployment rate is 9.5%. Critics of the first stimulus point to these job numbers and argue it was a mistake to spend that money in the first place. Others say that the first stimulus was too small and the country needs a second infusion of government spending. Vice President Joe Biden wrote an op-ed in the New York Times on Sunday calling for patience, saying that the Recovery Act is working. Well, this is our topic for today's Radio Times. And let me introduce our two guests. Justin Wolfers joins us here in our Philadelphia studios. He's an associate professor of business and public policy at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. And Justin Wolfers, nice to have you back with us on Radio Times.
Maddie, a pleasure.
And on the telephone is Jeffrey Myron. He's a senior lecturer in economics at Harvard University. And Jeffrey Myron, thank you for joining us as well.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me.
You're very welcome. And Jeffrey, let me begin with you. And I do want to talk about the first stimulus package before we get even into the second one. As you look at the spending over the last couple of months since February when the Recovery Act was passed, is it working?
Well, I think it's a little early to tell whether it's working for the simple reason that not so much of it has been spent. It's also hard to tell. Working for a lot of standard sort of social science statistical reasons, a lot of other things are going on. So parsing out exactly what the stimulus did versus what other things did is very difficult. My perspective is that it wasn't a good idea, not so much because it couldn't have had some beneficial short-term effect, but because it was likely to have bad long-term effects by allocating resources toward a lot of government resources toward projects which really don't make a huge amount of sense in the long term.
And I do want to get to that, but let me get to you, Justin Wolfers. As you look at the stimulus package, we're talking about almost 6 months after its passage. Is it working? Do you see signs of it working?
I think Jeff Myron's right to say it is too early to tell. There's stories out there, you know, a particular police chief or someone whose job was saved, but these are stories, not data. Last I heard, something like 10% of the package has been spent. That's going to have one-tenth the impact, and in any case, we expect some sort of delay in all of these things. The one thing that we do know is that there is a tremendous demand right now from the states for further money, and so we know that, at the very least, the states are claiming that they've got useful ways to spend either more of the later parts of this stimulus or a second go at it.
And states have to, unlike the federal government, the states generally have to balance their budget, so they have to figure out how to balance things out at the end of the fiscal year, and this is certainly happening in Pennsylvania.
And this is a huge problem if you think about it. What's the last thing you want to have happen during a recession? Governments firing people and adding to the burden. A balanced budget rule ends up meaning that that's exactly what they're doing. So the only circuit breaker here is the federal government. And, you know, some sort of federal grants, I think, could help, particularly, you know, you see states like California. You think we've got problems in Pennsylvania.
Indeed. Well, let me ask you about the 10%. I'll get back to you, Jeffrey Myron, but to you, Justin Wolfers, as you say, about 10% of the first stimulus package has been spent. Does that tell you it's really difficult to spend $787 billion or that there's some inefficiencies in the system, that the money hasn't gotten out into the economy?
There's no doubt that both are true. Spending a little bit of money is easy, spending a lot is hard, and doing anything through the federal government is extremely difficult. By the same token, getting money out there so that the states don't have to be firing people that they're already firing, that seems to be incredibly efficient. One of the features of this stimulus was that the government decided they wanted to go out and spend the money themselves to make sure that the money actually got spent. Certainly, you could worry about that creating certain log jams and the money not getting spent until 2012, 2013. The Bush administration actually tried something different. They just sent out checks.
Right.
The good thing about checks is they're really easy to print and get them in the mail, and you can do that in a couple of months. The bad thing is some people don't spend it, in which case you don't get the full stimulus impact that you might hope for. I think, you know, certainly my Republican friends think checks are a really good idea because they cut the government out, which has its own efficiencies. With the problem that maybe we don't get quite the macro oomph that we might want.
Let me turn back to you, Jeffrey Myron, and this is looking at what the Vice President wrote in the New York Times on Sunday, looking at the Recovery Act, and he said a third for a tax cut, a third for relief for states, state governments and for individuals, and a third for infrastructure jobs. Looking at that formula, do you have a problem with that?
Well, Basically, yes. First of all, the part that went for tax cuts was for mainly for tax cuts which were lump sum transfers, which were not reductions in tax rates and therefore didn't improve economic incentives in the economy as much as some other kinds of tax cuts would have, such as, say, a cut in the corporate income tax rate or in high marginal tax rates. The part going to the states, I think, in and of itself is okay. I think when you look at many state budgets, you see that over the long term, they're spending way, way more than my evaluation is appropriate for the state government. So there's the short-term problem, but then there's the fact that if we help them avoid cutting, then they're going to keep spending money on counterproductive things in the long term. The infrastructure part is certainly defensible, the federal infrastructure in principle, but again, I'm quite dubious about the specifics. While we can all find roads in our neighborhoods that need the potholes to be repaired, there also are huge highways across the middle of the country where nobody lives that are pretty hard to justify on efficiency grounds, and there's no guarantee we'll spend money fixing the potholes as opposed to creating more highways to nowhere.
I wonder what you say when the Obama administration, talking about the stimulus package, says, look, you know, we brought the economy back from the brink. We were on the edge of disaster. We had to spend this money. We had to try to get it into the economy. Do you buy that, Jeffrey Miron?
I don't buy that. I can't, certainly cannot prove that it's wrong, but I think some perspective is useful. There has only been one U.S. recession that became this enormous depression. That was in the late 20s and 30s. But if you look at the length of most recessions since even before the Fed, going back, you know, in the previous century and since World War II, the one we have now is a little bit deeper than most of those, and a fair bit deeper than some, but there was good reason to think that, gee, we would have started to recover about now just based on historical patterns. I think there was a huge amount of hype, a huge amount of scaring people to think that we were absolutely getting the Great Depression, but I don't think the evidence was there. So I think that mainly we're recovering because we were going to recover anyway.
What do you think, Justin Wolfers?
I think Jeff probably understates the case. In fact, I'd say it's almost a consensus among economists that this has been the biggest shock to the macro economy, certainly in my life as an economist. You've got someone as normally sober and staid as Ben Bernanke calling it Great Depression 2.0, which, you know, fortunately it hasn't turned out to be that bad. Jeff talked a little bit about how policymakers are out there scaring people, and I think that's right. And it may well turn out to have been one of the causes of the downturn. There's certainly an enormous crash in consumer confidence. And this is where I think actually the administration really did get things right with all the TARPs and TALFs and stimulus and every acronym you can imagine. The administration drew a line in the sand and said, Great Depression, it's not happening on our watch. And I think consumers have believed them. And, you know, that sort of talk has gone away. And maybe we're going to see over the next few months consumers returning back to the market.
But I wonder if the problem was created by overspending, I guess, on both consumer and government's part, overborrowing also on consumer and government part, and undersaving. Does this fix the problem? And I'll put that to you, Justin Wolfers.
I think we're still several decades away from economists figuring out what the heck caused it. I think
we'll get to you, Jeffrey. Hold on to that laugh.
I'd be interested in Jeff's hypothesis. Right. There's no doubt there was an enormous financial shock. The role that the financial economy plays in connecting savers and investors and therefore, you know, keeping things moving is something that we're certainly aware of, but we're not quite sure how much of our current downturn comes out of that. We are sure that somehow embedded in all of that, consumers stopped spending and investors stopped investing to a degree that we haven't seen in decades.
What do you think, Jeffrey?
Well, I fully agree with Justin that we're a long way from figuring it all out. I think in terms of this issue of are we spending too much, too little, do we borrow too much, but then all of a sudden we're trying to get people to borrow more to get us out of the recession, it's really a long run, short run. There's no question that the consensus is that to get the economy going in the short run, we need exactly the kinds of policies that were pursued. But my view is that when we do those things, we place way too little weight on the fact that when we do that, we then are going to tend to tie ourselves into ineffective spending, to excessive consumption and borrowing in the future. We generate moral hazards by rewarding people for having taken too much risk. And so we sow the seeds of the next crisis by responding in the way we do. So I would prefer to see us suffer more pain in the short term in exchange for putting things on a firmer basis, a better basis going forward. And we always say, well, we have to wait till next time because things are too terrible now, but that means we never get to doing the right things that make sense from a long-run perspective.
Are you saying we would return to our bad old habits, Jeffrey Miron?
Oh, I'm sure we will. In fact, I think the fact that we've bailed out huge banks with hundreds of billions of dollars and General Motors and other big firms, I think that just means the next time there's a significant downturn in the economy, there will be even more people pleading at the government's door, and they will probably get bailed out just as they did this time.
What do you think?
I think that's a really bad way to allocate resources.
Go ahead, Justin.
The thing I like about Jeff Miron is he is the most honest conservative economist I know. And so there's two sets of issues Jeff just raised. One is, if we start bailing people out, everyone else is going to come knocking on the government's door. And there's no doubt that's occurring. And the
Isn't
role,
there a T-shirt that says, where's my bailout?
I see you wearing it right now, Marty. I wouldn't be surprised if NPR hadn't asked for a little at some point. And that's certainly a dreadful way of allocating resources. And it's the role of good government to refuse bad requests, and it's the role of economists to help them refuse bad requests. The other part of Jeff's argument that I think is important to highlight is, this is the conservative fear. If you increase spending today, a bunch of programs are going to get set up, and then they'll just stay there forever. And then the flip side of this was sort of the Reagan argument that if we reduce taxes, that will force the dismantling of a bunch of programs, and then they'll stay dismantled forever. I'm not so sure that the evidence is as strong on this as might be suggested. Christina and David Romer have some very interesting research where they look at the effects of past tax cuts. And if government really was so sticky and couldn't change as circumstances changed, then tax cuts today would cause a smaller size of the government tomorrow. It actually turns out tax cuts today cause tax rises tomorrow. Mm. And so I could imagine the analogy of this argument being, Jeff is worried that if we increase government spending today, that it will stay high for a generation, and he wants to see a smaller size of government. I think it just turns out that government's not quite as sticky as we think, and as circumstances change, government spending's likely to change.
Do you agree, Jeffrey?
Well, I agree with half. I think he's absolutely right that what the Romer paper showed is that the tax cuts by themselves were not very good at restraining government. The Congress turned around and raised taxes again within a few years, typically, and so there wasn't much effect on spending. But the Romer paper also showed that when the governments increased taxes in order to finance more spending, you indeed got more spending, and that spending was way more than one for one. It ended up being much more expensive than what was initially allocated. And I think we have plenty of examples of programs which are now much, much bigger than when they were initially budgeted, have expanded in multiple ways, and so on. So I think on the spending side, the stickiness is indeed there. So I disagree with Justin a little bit on that.
Very quickly, Justin, because we're almost up on a break.
Yeah. It turns out Jeff and I agree here. Let's just go to the break.
Go to the break. Okay. Fair enough. We can see who's running the show here. That's Justin Wolfertz. He's an associate professor of business and public policy at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania here in our Philadelphia studios. And on the telephone is Jeffrey Miron. He's a senior lecturer in economics at Harvard University. And we invited both of them to join us today in Radio Times to talk about whether the stimulus is working, the first stimulus package. We've been talking about that. And we do want to tackle the question about whether the country needs a second stimulus. And we're opening up the lines for your phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
Fox Chase Cancer Center supports WHYY and reminds listeners to protect themselves against the sun's harmful rays this summer. Skin cancer is the most common form of cancer in the U.S. One out of every five Americans will develop skin cancer in the course of a lifetime. Early detection and an appropriate treatment plan are keys to best outcomes. More information at foxchase.org or 1-888-FOX-CHASE. Fox Chase, perfecting the science of compassionate cancer care.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. It's 10:20. Ahead in the second hour at 11, a look at whether we can and should manipulate the climate to combat global warming. WHYY weather, a high of 90 degrees this afternoon. Expect a hazy, hot, and humid day with a chance of a late day or evening thunderstorm. Then partly cloudy overnight, low falling back to 71 degrees. Tomorrow and Thursday, the chance of showers and storms in the afternoon, high each day around 88 degrees.
On the next Radio Lab, a story about how the country's most brilliant doctors did exactly what they were supposed to do.
And wound up killing 20,000, 30,000 people or so before it was over with.
The question we'll ask is,
How did this happen?
No, that's not the right question. The question is, why would they do such a stupid thing?
Yeah, that is the question, isn't it?
Yeah, that's the question.
Find out on the next Radiolab.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoenzo. Do we need another stimulus package with unemployment rates at 9.5%? Some economists are calling for a second stimulus package. Was the $787 billion first stimulus package not enough? We're hearing two perspectives from two economists today on Radio Times. Jeffrey Miron on the telephone, a senior lecturer in economics at Harvard University, and Justin Wolver is an associate professor of business and public policy at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. And we've got calls coming into 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Now, I know economists love to argue about some of the minutia, but the important minutia of the economy. But go ahead, Justin. You wanted to say something right before the break.
Yeah, I think it's worth separating the two arguments that are going on. One is the usual textbook argument for or against running a deficit. And this is just, should the government spend more today when there's unemployment is high and the economy has a lot of slack, and in return spend less tomorrow? And I think on that there's actually broad agreement. And so the subtext informing the debate between Jeff and I really is some economists want the size of government to be small and some want it to be large. This is the usual left-right divisions that's right down the middle of so much politics. And the problem is that those who would rather the size of government be small are afraid that if we expand spending today, that spending will stay around in the future, in which case what was meant to be a cyclical effect actually turns out to play into this bigger ideological debate.
Well, let me ask you, and then I'll turn back to you, Jeffrey Miron, but let me ask you, so, I mean, do you believe that through government spending, through a first and possibly a second stimulus package, that the government can fix some of these problems in the economy that we're talking about and bring down the unemployment rate?
Yes. The old argument is the government starts spending. When the government spends, someone has to do the work to build the bridge, build the road. They spend some more money, the shopkeeper gets some more money, has to hire another shop assistant, and so on. There are enormous questions about how effective that is. There's no doubt that I think it's fair to say the profession of economists, we don't know exactly how big any of this is. I think our best guess is it works. It may not. But as the circumstances today are, we can't rely on monetary policy because interest rates are down at zero.
Right.
The economy is in a dreadful situation, so we can do something. And we also may even be still worried about deflation. And if prices start falling, people will stop spending even more, and things could get much worse relatively quickly.
What do you think, Jeffrey Miron?
Well, I'd like to add a comment that I think addresses a bunch of things that Justin just said. His outline about the difference between the two positions, I fully agree with. That's why I focus on saying that if there was a stimulus, there should have been mainly tax cuts, not expenditure increases, because whether we should be doing the expenditure should be done separately, and it should be done slowly and thoughtfully on cost-benefit grounds, not rushed into place. First, as Justin indicated, the evidence on whether the spending increases usefully stimulate the economy is somewhat mushy. It's certainly not as reassuring as one would like. The evidence on whether the tax cuts stimulate the economy, again, happens to come from Romer and Romer, Christina Romer, the chairman of the Council of Economic Advisors, seems pretty compelling, pretty convincing. And in the textbook Keynesian model, tax cuts are a perfectly effective way to stimulate the economy, and in the data, they seem to be a perfectly effective way. So that allows you to kind of have your cake and eat it, too, to improve the efficiency by adjusting downward appropriate taxes and to stimulate, whereas if we're making decisions about what roads to build, we want to do it slowly and thoughtfully, so we don't just hire people to dig ditches and build them back up, which is the extreme caricature of the Keynesian argument. Instead, we hire people to build bridges and roads that we really need, but that takes time and thought to do carefully and do well.
Do tax cuts, though, Jeffrey, create jobs?
Sure. I mean, if you, say, cut the investment corporate income tax rate, or if you pass a temporary investment tax credit, that provides a good incentive for corporations to want to build new factories, add more equipment to their factories, and they need people to build those factories and work on those factories and so on. So there's absolutely no... And if you do it on the consumer side, okay, it may be relatively weak effect if you do a temporary thing like the Bush administration stimulus one, but if you did a more permanent tax cut on the personal income tax side, that puts more hands in consumers' pockets. They then spend that on some goods and services, which has then the standard multiplier effects that the Keynesian spending stimulus is supposed to have. So there's no reason it can't be done through tax cuts, and in my view, it would be preferable.
Go ahead, Justin. What's your response to that?
I think we agree that you can stimulate the economy with tax cuts. You can stimulate the economy by spending more money. We're somewhat uncertain about the extent of each. And Jeff has a view that every time you cut taxes or reduce the size of government, that makes the world more efficient, and people on the left have a different view. And we're not going to resolve that side of it today.
I wonder, though, and perhaps I can go back to you, Jeffrey Myron. I mean, just how concerned, whether there's more government spending or more tax cuts, both of those, each of those, and certainly those together, are going to increase the deficit, at least in the short term. Does that concern you?
The short term, no, it doesn't particularly concern me. I certainly fully agree with Justin that worrying about the deficit in the middle of a big recession makes no sense whatsoever. And indeed, the state rules that they can't have unbalanced budgets in the short term seems fairly counterproductive. The long-term deficit situation in the United States, I think, is potentially very concerning if much of the stimulus spending ends up being relatively long-lasting and not temporary for just a year or two. If some of the health care plans that are being discussed get passed, then the long-term deficit situation in the U.S. is really bad. Indeed, even the existing health care plans, Medicare and Medicaid, are going to put huge pressure on the long-term deficit. But the short-term aspect of trying to stimulate, no, that's not an issue.
Are you concerned that other countries won't want our debt? Is that what you're saying?
That's certainly one of the issues. I mean, it also just means that the government is going to have to raise taxes to try to make up those deficits, and those taxes have negative incentive effects. I mean, there's certainly disagreement amongst economists, as just indicated, about exactly how much. But if there are major increases in tax rates, I think most economists would accept that these are a drag on economic activity.
How do you see deficits, Justin?
In the medium to long run, we want to be running the government about balanced. We're right now in a once-in-a-generation recession. It's the right time to be running a deficit. And the really important thing is to make sure when we're in a once-in-a-generation boom that we're running surpluses. And the real failure of U.S. fiscal policy has been the failure to run surpluses during good times. And we absolutely are going to need the discipline to do that.
How do we do that, though?
Well, I think we elect responsible politicians, easier said than done. Yeah, the amazing thing has been this. Reagan ran enormous deficits, irresponsible deficits, and I think Bush did too. Eventually, it seems voters have enough, and so deficits do come back on the political and policy agenda when it really starts to endanger things. Mm. And so maybe we are going to see in one or two or three elections' time people starting to care a lot about seeing a credible deficit reduction program. And I will say I think the current administration has at least laid out a plan. Whether they're going to be able to stick to it is a much harder question. But at the very least, one of the things I liked about the current approach is here's how we're going to spend more today and here's our plan for spending less tomorrow.
Give us, though, your argument for why the country needs a second stimulus. As both you and Jeffrey say, have said on the air, only about 10% or so of the first stimulus has been spent. Why do we need a second one?
So why we need any stimulus is when things are bad and you can do something about it, you should do something about it. The logic is that simple. Why a second one, given that we already have a first one? The economy just turned out to be worse than we thought. And so if a pretty bad outcome required a pretty big stimulus. It turns out we got a really bad outcome. So the same logic, I think, says that you need a really big stimulus. If we knew in January what we know now about the state of the economy, the stimulus would have been a lot larger, or it should have been a lot larger. And so it's not too late to undo that. People might be worried about, let the first one run its course, or but we have some sense of how the first one's going to go. It's going to help, but things are worse and we need more help. People might say we're close to a turning point, and they may be right, but even the most optimistic forecasts I've seen still suggest we're going to have very, very high unemployment, not just for 2 years, but 3, 4, or 5 years out. And so it's actually thinking not about next year, but thinking about 2012, 2013, that really demands thinking hard about another stimulus.
And is it the unemployment number that you look at to try to figure out whether the stimulus, one or two, or the two of them together, are working or not?
There's actually an interesting debate here among economists. So right now, the unemployment rate's 9.5%. At the end of 2010, most projections say it's going to be exactly the same, 9.5%. So it's pretty grim for a long way out. Economists look at something else called the output gap, which is how much we're producing as a country relative to our potential. And it turns out that while the unemployment numbers look dreadful, the output gap only looks bad.
Huh.
So if you cared a lot about the output gap, then you wouldn't be so keen on a second stimulus. And you've heard some of this coming out of the administration recently. Now, the output gap is actually quite important because the output gap is what we think determines inflation. And so if you, you know, overstimulated the economy, inflation would pick up. Now, there's almost no chance of overstimulating the economy over the next 2 or 3 years. But that would be the argument for looking at the output gap rather than unemployment.
What do you look at, Jeffrey Miron, to try to figure out if the economy is getting better or if any of these programs are working or not?
Well, I think what Justin outlined is exactly right. We look mainly at unemployment and the output gap. There are, of course, all sorts of supplementary indicators, home prices, home sales, and all those things. But those are just kind of smaller pieces of this overall sort of output gap. But I think he raised exactly the right issue, which is that if we think that, at least in terms of output gap, we may be reasonably turning the corner and we're starting to have some risk that we could be stimulating when the economy is growing at a reasonable rate, that's one reason to be cautious about a second stimulus. I mean, more broadly, monetary policy in the time being has been extremely expansionary. That almost certainly is appropriate. But there is an issue of what to do as the economy starts to pick up, in terms of making sure all the liquidity the Fed has put in the economy doesn't turn into inflation, if you have more and more spending going on just when the Fed is trying to is starting to have to worry about inflation, that makes the Fed's job a bit more difficult. So that's another concern. But again, I would say if the stimulus package, a new stimulus package, takes the form of things which will actually not only stimulate in the short term but help make the economy more efficient in the long term, i.e., tax cuts in tax rates, then I would have no objection because those are good things to do regardless of these other considerations. Whereas the additional spending, I think it's very hard to convince a lot of economists that there's really a lot of new spending that needs to be done that makes sense on cost-benefit grounds, that you'd want to do independent, have the government do independent of the recession. But I'm afraid a lot of that's going to stick around well after we are out of the recession.
But even in things like, let's say, investing in education or the environment, I mean, you don't see a kind of a return or a benefit to those kinds of investments, even if they are costly?
I don't think that the things that would make our educational system work better involve spending more money, not at all. Now, my view is, as Justin will make a comment on, is a somewhat unusual view. It's not a completely lone wolf view, but I think that changing the way that we treat teachers' unions, allowing more charters and more vouchers and various other decreases in government regulation of schools would actually cost us less money and make education system more effective. And so we shouldn't be spending more money. That means we'll just perpetuate the bad systems that we already have in place rather than forced to think about doing things in a more efficient way.
I don't like to give labels to people, but are you, Jeffrey Miron, a libertarian? I mean, would that be...
I am absolutely libertarian.
A libertarian. I mean, just
no doubt about
just
it.
I won't say come clean here, but just so we understand a little bit of the perspective that you come from. And Justin Wolfers, I mean, if he's a libertarian, you're a liberal?
I'm not allowed to vote in this country, but if I voted, I'd vote Democratic.
You would, okay. Let me just quickly reintroduce the two of you. Jeffrey Miron is a senior lecturer in economics at Harvard University. Justin Wolfers is an associate professor of business and public policy at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. We invited them to join us today on Radio Times to talk about a whole host of things. First of all, taking a look at the first stimulus package and trying to figure out whether it's working or not, talking about whether we need a second stimulus package or not, and just taking a look and getting two very different perspectives on how the U.S. economy works. 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. Justin, I know you wanted to add something to what Jeffrey was saying.
Sure. I just think it's really important for listeners to be able to distinguish between two very important and very different economic concepts. One is a turning point, and that's what journalists are really focused on right now. Is there a turning point in the economy? We might be near one, for all I know. A turning point is when things have stopped getting worse. When we think about things like the unemployment rate or the output gap, we're thinking about, are things bad? And so even if we hit a turning point, it's still going to be the case that things are bad, and things are bad for quite a way out. When people talk about inflation, that is when the economy, inflation is likely to become a problem, would only become a problem when the economy is back to producing at its level of potential. Mm-hmm. And so that's when things are no longer bad. Now, almost every forecast says things are likely to be bad for at least 3 or 4 years. Another way of saying that is, even if we hit a turning point, inflation is not coming back on the horizon for a long, long time.
But you said you're worried about deflation.
I'm worried about deflation. If prices start to fall, I'm going to stop spending. I think other people might stop spending.
Well, wouldn't they start? I mean, if prices fall, I mean, for instance, you're seeing home sales are up. They're not the way they were you know, a couple of years ago. But nonetheless, aren't people taking advantage of the lower house prices in order to get in on the housing market?
Sure. But deflation is when prices are continually falling. So then it, you're always going to get a better deal tomorrow than you get today, or in fact, the day after. The real problem here is what people respond to is what we call the real interest rate, which is interest rate relative to the level of inflation. Well, if the level of inflation is negative, then that actually means that the real interest rate is even higher. It makes it even more difficult to borrow to buy a house or something like that. And this is exactly the wrong time to see real interest rates rise.
Mm. Are you worried about deflation, Jeffrey Myron?
I guess I'm less worried. I fully agree with the general analysis that Justin gave. I don't think there's too much dispute about that. It seems to me, my hunch is that we're looking at the risk of inflation sooner than 3 to 4 years, that the models that people use to do these forecasts tend to have a lot of sort of persistence built in. They tend to see tomorrow as being a lot like today, and they're not good at predicting whether recovery will be fast or slow. But it's certainly true that there are a lot of obstacles for the U.S. economy, so maybe those forecasts are right. Mm. But I still would be concerned about not thinking ahead about what happens when there is a risk of inflation and what impact will fiscal stimulus have on managing the inflation going forward. So I'm not disagreeing with Justin very much at all, just mild matters of degree.
Let me add one thing I'm sure we'll both agree on.
Okay.
One, here's a lot of media commentary by various nuts, to be honest, talking about the risk of hyperinflation. Hyperinflation is not happening in our lifetimes, and it's not happening in following the recovery to this recession. It's off
and
the table.
And you promise that this is a guarantee?
Your listeners can come and lynch me if I'm wrong on this, and I'm willing to bet that Jeff's willing to put up the same bet, too.
I'll put up the same bet. Yes, I fully agree. That the talk about hyperinflation is nutty.
Well,
the risk that we could get 5 or 10% inflation 5 or 10 years from now, that's certainly a risk. But we're not talking about hyperinflation. That's really silly.
Well, but it is interesting, as you say, that there are many people that are playing, I think, certain emotional angles to this debate. And I wonder even just how much you think, and I'll put this to you, Justin, how much you think psychology is at play here. We talk about consumer confidence, you know, and whether people feel as if, you know, buying a house today makes sense looking ahead to tomorrow. But just how much do you think the psychology of the American people is driving the U.S. economy?
It could well be a really big factor. I mean, fear is everywhere. And fear manifests itself in lots of ways. One is we're less likely to buy, say, a new car. Another is something you were just alluding to, the demand for oracles, for divine wisdom. Honestly, nutty economists often who are willing to say whatever the heck it is you want to hear has never been higher. And I think, you know, sometimes...
Because people are scared, aren't they?
People are scared. And, you know, what fear leads us to want and grasp on funny things sometimes. And so I do actually... One of the things I've been disappointed by is sort of the marketplace of ideas maybe has started to has become a little dysfunctional during the crisis, partly because there's so many of us who really are looking for something, and sometimes charlatans are rising to the top.
Let's take that short break, and we'll get back to our conversation. That's Justin Wolfers. He's an associate professor of business and public policy, and that's at the Wharton School of the University of Pennsylvania. Joining us by telephone, Jeffrey Myron. He's a senior lecturer in economics at Harvard University. Both of them joining us today on Radio Times as we talk about the U.S. economy, the stimulus package, the possibility of a second stimulus, and we'll start taking some phone calls at 1-888-477-9499. That's 1-888-477-WHYY. And Jeffrey, I do want to read something about some of your ideas, libertarian ideas, to stimulate the economy.
Wintertour presents Faces of a New Nation, American portraits of the 18th and early 19th centuries from the Metropolitan Museum of Art, now on view. Featuring portraits of the men, women, and children of early America. Wintertour is the sole venue for this group of portraits from the Met, including artists John Singleton Copley and Gilbert Stuart. Details at 800-448-3883. Or wintertour.org. Wintertour Museum and Country Estate proudly supports WHYY.
It's 10:40. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. In the second hour at 11, a look at whether we can and should manipulate the climate to combat global warming. WHYY weather, hazy, hot, and humid. This afternoon's high 90 degrees. There is a chance of a late day or evening shower or storm. Otherwise, partly cloudy overnight, low falling back to 71. Tomorrow and Thursday, hazy, hot, and humid. Each day features the chance of afternoon showers or storms, and high both days around 88.
I'm Robin Young. Join us next time for the news and these stories here and now. Some experts are now saying the economy is better, so how come it doesn't feel that way? Also, the life and career of the late mountaineer and photographer Brad Washburn. That's Public Radio's daily digest of news and culture here and now.
Today at noon on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscone, talking with Jeffrey Myron and Justin Wolfers about the U.S. economy and the state of the economy, the future of the economy, taking a look at the effects of the first stimulus package and wondering whether a second stimulus package makes sense or not. Jeffrey, I do want to just quote something that I saw on CNN.com, and this is from you, Commentary: Libertarian Ideas to Stimulate the Economy. And I just want to pick a couple of them because you've touched on some of them earlier. Moderate the growth of entitlements, eliminate wasteful spending, withdraw from Iraq and Afghanistan, limit union power, renew the U.S. commitment to free trade, expand legal immigration, stop bailing out businesses that took too much. I mean, in 2 minutes or less, if from your perspective, if we did those things, we would fix our economy?
Well, I don't think those things are necessarily going to have prevented or maybe not even have shortened the recession. I think the recession was sort of in the cake. It was already going to happen because of misallocations that happened with respect to risk-taking and housing prices and all that sort of stuff. But I think doing those things would put us on a firmer foundation going forward. They are things which make the economy more productive, whereas I see a lot of the things that we've done as part of the stimulus as being counterproductive. And one or two of the things that I mentioned there, for free trade, cutting the corporate income tax in particular, would also certainly have beneficial stimulus effects. Some of them might have beneficial effects in a somewhat sort of less tangible way. If we had our deficit situation on a good long-term path, that might mean the rest of the world would be much more willing to continue to lend to us and keep interest rates we have to pay to roll over our debt from going up. That would be beneficial, perhaps even in the short term. But mainly what I'm pushing there is we should think about the long term, not just about the short term. And so those are things that the U.S. economy should do independent of the recession.
And Justin, I'm looking at just a couple of things here. Withdraw from Iraq and Afghanistan. I mean, I think easier said than done, but nonetheless, we have invested a lot of money in those two wars. Expand legal immigration, stop bailing out businesses that took on too much risk. Do you disagree with those three?
In fact, I was surprised that Jeff's libertarian list was actually the Democratic talking points.
Is this the world we live in, though?
Some of it is and some of it isn't. Yeah. I mean, there's I think, immense agreement about the need to do things like sort out medium-run entitlement spending. It's just such a huge part of the deficit, of the budget going forward.
Sure.
Aging population.
Baby boomers retiring, that kind of
absolutely.
Thing.
Absolutely. And, you know, that's an important set of issues. And I think figuring out the medium and long-term parts of the budget are absolutely critical. They're separate from the short-term, how should we respond to the recession debate.
Let me get to Arthur from Berwyn to join us. Hi, Arthur. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Marty, thank you again for the opportunity to ask the question.
Sure, go ahead.
Very quickly, I want to provide some context to my question. I am a military officer. I am in the Marine Corps Reserve. And I think what strikes me about the conversation we're having as it relates to deficits, deficit spending, the stimulus, and in particular, healthcare reform, is military spending. You know what strikes me about military spending, and I can't believe I'm saying this, is we are buying stuff that doesn't make it any more safe. It's incredibly expensive. I'm sure your guests and your listeners heard about the F-22 story. Classic example. And what strikes me specifically, and I wanted to get some commentary for both your guests about military spending, is we carry on about the spending that's projected from the CBO, and by the way, the CBO is not clear that it can cost everything out as it relates to a public option for health care. I just find it laughable when it's compared to military spending, particularly when we talk about legacy systems, which still, by the way, make up the bulk of our DOD spending for wars that we will never fight again.
Well, you know what, Arthur,
not in our lifetime.
Let me take your point. I think it's a very interesting one, and I'll actually toss it to you, Jeffrey Myron, as you talk about eliminating wasteful spending. How much of a spotlight on the Department of Defense then?
Oh, I think a very significant spotlight. Now, I'm not an expert on the details of the military budget or military activities, but certainly we've committed a huge amount of resources in Iraq and Afghanistan in ways that, to me, have not generated benefit for the U.S. or for the Middle East. So, to me, that's just incredibly wasteful. On things like specific weapons program, the F-22, I think, you know, there may be a case that that was a bad weapons program. I just don't have the details. Right. That's not my area. But what I think was interesting is that the administration said, we're not going to spend money on this because it's not a good way to spend money. It doesn't basically meet the cost-benefit test. And yet, if you looked at that program from the perspective of creating jobs, you would say, oh, well, from a short-term stimulus perspective, it's perfectly fine. It's hiring people and, therefore, is a good stimulus thing. So they came down on the we spend money on what makes sense from cost-benefit terms for that project. And yet, I think there was a lot of fuzziness about whether all the spending in the stimulus package, in fact, was really easy to justify from a cost-benefit perspective.
What do you think, Justin?
I think one of the most difficult things for economists and the general public in any of this is just tracking the magnitudes involved. And so, you know, you can compare the projected cost of healthcare reform. It turns out to be about equal to the Bush tax cuts. And then you can think about, you know, OMB just announced $100 million in government efficiencies, which sounds like a lot until you remember that the word million begins with M, not B. And actually turns out to be second order relative to all of this stuff. And, you know, I think that keeps a lot of the attention away from defense, where there's a lot of billions floating around.
But do you think looking ahead, and one could argue this is a good thing or a bad thing, but to you, Justin, that in order to address the problems in this country, that we're going to be more like Europe? They're going to be more like European governments in terms of programs and spending and the relationship between citizens and their government?
I'm not quite sure what the question is. Do I think that Americans are going to vote for a European welfare state?
Or whether we vote for it or not, but sort of that's the direction that we're moving in?
So I think you want to separate direction from magnitude here. At a time like this, there's almost no doubt that there's going to be greater demand for social insurance. And if you ranked all the industrialized countries in terms of the generosity of their welfare safety net, the U.S. is currently last and will certainly still be last at the end of this period. So,
because that's what, the American way?
It seems to be the preference of the voters, and that's what politicians deliver. So next talking point, you hear that we're becoming more like Europe. It's true, but it's only infinitesimally true.
What do you think, Jeffrey?
I would agree with what Justin said. It's only infinitesimally true. In terms of whether it would be good to be more like European government, I have very, very mixed feelings as a libertarian. On many social issues, I think the Europeans do a much better job than the U.S. Tolerance of sort of gays in the military, of gay marriage, of legalizing drugs, decriminalizing drugs, and things like that. On the amount of social welfare spending, I think that both the U.S. and Europe are beyond the level that is productive. I think there's a clear case for that spending, but in moderation. And I would say Europe has certainly gone too far, and the U.S. has probably gone too far. So I have a very mixed reaction, but I agree with Justin. We're not going to get there anytime soon, but we are moving this maybe a smidge in that direction.
Let me get to Mark from Downingtown to join us. Mark, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi.
Hi there.
I just wanted to talk about a few different items that they were talking about. I don't think that the middle class is always at the forefront of what would benefit most from a lot of the stimulus packages that are going on. I think the middle class needs to be at the center. One of the things that frightens me is that the states across, you know, just every single state is they're in an area now where they want to lay people off. They want to slash their budgets. They want to balance their budgets. And they're acting in the opposite way that we should act right now, as far as, at, you know, on one hand, they have high unemployment, and the other hand, they are being a reason for high unemployment. As far as...
Mark, yeah, can you just ask your question only because we got some more callers, and I think I know where you're going with your point, but I need you to just be more specific.
It's not really a question per se. It's just, you know, I don't really hear these guys speaking about what's good for the middle class. And when I hear things about I don't understand any idea of why you would want to lower taxes right now. Also, it just sounds like something Grover Norquist at the center of his argument is that, you know, basically what you want to do is you want to strip all social entitlement programs away from the economy by bankrupting the economy, by lowering taxes.
Well, let me take that point, and I'll give Jeffrey Myron a chance to respond to that, and then I'll turn to Justin Wolf first. Jeffrey, is that what you want to do?
I'm not quite sure I know how to answer that question. I think that if we're going to have a bigger deficit with spending or tax cuts, then that's going to put pressure on other pre-existing programs, such as middle-class entitlement programs. So the fact that we might use tax cuts doesn't necessarily push us one way or the other in terms of the pre-existing programs. So in terms of whether the stimulus is aimed at the middle class, I think, certainly some of it was. Some of the tax credits for children and things like that, or some of the spending is going to go for people who are very much middle class, R&D for clean energy, that's going to hire scientists and engineers who are very much middle class. A lot of the spending on construction and roads is going to go to people who have sort of blue-collar, reasonable incomes. Relatively little of it went to people who are very poor. Of course, there were the unemployment insurance extensions and expansions. That's to people who are at least temporarily out of work and therefore in worse shape. But I think I disagree. I think a reasonable fraction of it did go to the middle class.
Do you agree with that, Justin?
Yeah. I mean, Mark asked what's good for the middle class.
Well, exactly.
What's bad for the middle class? Unemployment. Unemployment doesn't hit those who are highly educated, the upper echelons, and if you were fired from Merrill Lynch, chances are you found another job by now, or you can find one pretty quickly. So I see a whole lot of this being about calming the anxieties, very legitimate anxieties of the middle class. One might worry more about the working class through this. Recessions tend to hit the poor more than they hit the middle class. And so far, an undue burden, in my view, mm-hmm. has been hit by the poor. And one might even worry about if the economy's bad enough for long enough, the possibility of an underclass emerging and the very poor forming an entirely new underclass. So it's
a new
the very
and perhaps bigger underclass as well, or just more poor people.
Unemployment and poverty becoming somehow institutionalized mm-hmm. if we have 5 years of families and their neighbors without jobs.
Well, this is a very gloomy scenario, but I've been reading more about it, and the idea of a jobless recovery, in a sense that the banks begin to lend, and there are some these green shoots, there's signs of growth in the economy, but you see people who are unemployed and staying unemployed, or perhaps being underemployed. Are you concerned about that, Jeffrey?
I certainly would be concerned about it. I guess I think that we're being a little pessimistic. My hunch is we're being a little pessimistic. I mean, certainly it's a standard phenomenon of most recessions that unemployment is a lagging indicator. So the mere fact that aspects of GDP are giving some indication of recovering and unemployment has not yet, that is completely consistent with past recoveries in which eventually unemployment did go down, employment did recover. And obviously the unemployment in some ways sows the seeds of its own elimination. When there are a lot of people unemployed, it puts downward pressure on wages, and that mm-hmm. gives private companies an incentive to go out and locate in areas where there are a lot of low-wage workers and things like that. In the last recession, in the recovery from the 2001 recession, there was a lot of talk from some of the liberal commentators in the blogosphere about how it wasn't really a good recovery because people weren't getting jobs, but lo and behold, 6 months to a year later, in fact, the recovery in employment was there. So it's certainly cause for concern, and maybe this situation is different, but I think it's a little early to jump to that conclusion.
What do you think, Justin?
Jeff's patient, willing to wait it out, but I think he's more patient than people who don't have jobs. Right now, the sunniest forecast still suggests that in December 2010, the unemployment rate will be at the same high level it's at today, and it will probably remain high for another 2-3 years after that. That's one concern. Another is, when we talk about an unemployment rate of 9.5%, that's not counting all the people who are sort of looking for work, or they're part-time employed looking for more work, or they're in a makeshift job, or a tremendous number of people heading back to school simply to wait out the recession. But the thing I'm really fearful of is this recession is different from any other if you look at the number of people who've been out of work for a long time. So right now, typically when people are unemployed in this country, they're unemployed maybe for 3 months. Right now, well over half of the workforce of the unemployed have been unemployed for more than 3 months. About 40% have been unemployed for at least 6 months. And once people start to become unemployed for half a year, maybe a year, they start to lose good habits. They start to lose habits. They start to lose connection. They start to lose hope. And one wonders whether those people are going to be able to go back to work when things do get better.
Something very serious to think about. Let me get Bob from Germantown, our last caller today on Radio Times. Bob, go ahead. You're on the air.
That me? Okay.
That's you.
My question was about deflation that you were talking about earlier. And it seems that that it's gotten to be known that most of the wealth that this country has gathered in the last 20 years or so has been artificial wealth in many ways, and it's kind of disappeared because it's not real. But it's caused all the prices of everything to be high, and the prices are not going down. And when prices go down, we have deflation, which I understand why you would be difficult which would cause difficulties. But I don't understand how we can avoid it, because people can't afford the prices, which are still going up. Food prices, everything is going up. And why is that?
Well, and we're almost out of time. Jeffrey Myron, I'm going to toss that to you. I mean, do you see that the wealth that has been created in the last 20 years or so, the way Bob does, as a kind of artificial wealth?
I think there's an element that was artificial that he's right about. There was a housing bubble. There's very, very little dispute about that. Houses got to a price that seemed to make no sense based on historical patterns or fundamentals in, say, cities in the Southwest where there were no space constraints. Nevertheless, housing prices were just going through the roof. So there was certainly an element of that artificial wealth and other asset prices built on top of that. Over a 20-year horizon, that seems a bit of an exaggeration, and I think we've gotten to the point where a lot of that artificial wealth has now been kind of wrung out of the system with the housing prices down and the stock prices down. So I guess I don't quite take the point, and I don't see the prices overall in the economy as being, you know, too high or not coming down. I don't think there's a reason to think that they should be coming down in the way that the caller seemed to suggest.
What are your thoughts? We're almost out of time here, Justin.
Sure. Bob seemed to be worried that prices were rising. A lot of us notice prices rising when we're starting to feel a pinch. But the best measurements we have, the official inflation rate, suggest they're really not rising. And so maybe we're forgetting things about Walmart comes to town, or the low prices we see at Costco, or even just, you know, fast food meals. Prices actually have been remarkably stable actually for 10 years. Bob's right to say what we really care about is people's incomes relative to the price level. The way economists think about that is, well, let's go out there and raise incomes.
Well, on that note, much more to talk about. Justin Wolfers, thank you for joining us today in Radio Times. And Jeffrey Myron, thank you very much as well.
Thank you. My pleasure.
You're welcome. And go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Leave us an email. Find out more about the program, including podcasts. I'm Marty Moscoen. Thank you so much for joining us. And you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware.